Welcome to the New Diplomatist Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Garrison Morado, and today I have a very special guest from the Hudson Institute, Dr. Pandi, who's coming on board to talk about her latest book that's just been published by HarperCollins, Making India Great. Dr. Pandi, it is a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Garrison. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast with you.
Well, we're very happy to have you here. And could you give just a brief introduction to the listeners of your storied career and your educational background, and then we'll get to talking about the book.
Sure, thank you. So I grew up in India, in the capital city, Delhi. I did my undergrad and master's in history. And then I did a second master's in international relations. I worked for a few years with the United Nations program in India. And then I came in 2004 to Boston University to do my PhD in international relations. But I'm one of those who actually came to the States because I wanted to work at a think tank. Think tanks interested me, policy work interests me. And so while I love teaching and I enjoy academia, it's the think tank policy world that really, really appeals to me.
That's wonderful. And we're very lucky to have you here in the States contributing to that research and benefiting the Hudson Institute and many of the publications. I've written for the Huffington Post and American Interest and even abroad, Hindustan Times, Sunday Guardian. So we're all benefiting from that knowledge and from your travels here. So we do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Today we're going to focus in on that latest book of yours that just recently came out, I believe in the last couple months, correct?
Actually, mid-August.
Mid-August. Okay, perfect. So very recent. Called Making India Great, The Promise of a Reluctant Global Power. Would you care just to unpack a little bit of the very broad initial motivation for writing this particular book at this particular moment?
Of course, Garrison. So, you see, if you sort of living in the United States, you see what's happening around the world. You see that in the last few years, the United States has started to worry about the rise of China. There's the new policy called the Indo-Pacific policy. And there has been a demand that countries around the world, both formal allies and new partners, join with the United States to uphold the liberal international order. One of the many countries that the US, Japan, Europe, sort of Australia, Southeast Asia, many countries around the world are seeking as a partner has been India. They would like India to play a bigger role. And it's rare. It's rare for other countries to want another country to become a peer competitor, to play a bigger role on the global stage. So why is it that they want India to rise? Why is it that other countries want India to play a bigger role? It's the same thing within India. For the last 72 years, ever since India gained independence from British rule, a large number of Indians believe that India deserves to be on the global high table. The reason I wrote the book is, yes, as an Indian, even I would like India to play a bigger role and to be a global power. But I believe that there's an assumption that just because India is one of two 1.3 billion population countries or one of two countries, one of two civilizations that has been there for 5,000 years, that will automatically make India into a global or a great power. What people forget is, just because I want to be a great power and others want me to become one doesn't mean that I have to do nothing. And so the book looks at why is it that India has not become great or a global power and what are the challenges India faces in various arenas.
Well, that's an excellent topic to be pursuing. As you said, I think the timing of the world almost worked out perfectly to be set up for this book because there is such a question currently regarding China, as you said, also even regarding American leadership, and not to drag you into domestic politics, of course, but if President Donald Trump does win again, there is an assumption that there will continue to be something of a stepping back, I think we can put it that way, for the United States from its more active globalist role. But absolutely. I found in your introduction in particular, some of the comparisons you made were fascinating to me. You said that the sense of Indian exceptionalism that the country's founding father spoke about and that the average Indian believes in comes from the seeming inevitability of its rise to great power status. For Indians, India's greatness is a given. The only question is when and how it will manifest itself on the world stage. Do you feel like that's a question that the current Modi administration is properly grappling with right now, or is this something currently more engaged in the academic realm that needs to be moved to the policy discussions in New Delhi?
So, Garthan, I believe that the current administration, the current government believes it. The Modi government believes it, but I believe that previous governments have believed it also. The difference is this. I may believe that I deserve something, but my belief that I deserve something does not mean that I will automatically get that position or post, right?
Yes.
I need to work for it. So, you know, let's say when I was coming to the US in 2004, I got admission to a PhD program. That did not mean that I would get the PhD degree. I had to work for 4 years. I had to complete coursework. I had to write a dissertation. I had to defend a dissertation.
Yes.
So the problem is not desire. I believe that every Indian government, right from 1947, and actually even before the freedom struggle, Indian leaders believed that India would play a bigger role. The problem is lack of implementation of policies, and especially lack of planning and consistent policies in every area, whether it is the social, economic, military, foreign policy. So lack of ambition isn't there. The policies and long-term strategy that will help you achieve your ambition is what I believe has been lacking, or is there in sporadic bursts, and then it disappears.
Well, that makes sense. And heading into sort of the first chapter, I feel like that's a good place to begin to further talk about this, because you make mention of the fact that I think it's not entirely surprising that there is a sort of assumption that India will become one of the leading, if not the leading, global powers over the next century because of what they've accomplished in the last 100 years. I mean, 100 years ago, it was a British colony, as you talk about. The fact that in a post-colonial age so recently that it has boomed to such significant economic power, growing hard military power, global influence is very significant. But there's one line in the first chapter I found very interesting. You said the struggle between two contending imaginings of India, one modern and secular and the other conservative and religious, continues into the 21st century. And you talk about that as one of the defining aspects of the balance between its history and its future. Could you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. So one is the domestic part of that idea, and one is the impact it has on, India's external relations. The domestic level, it's easy to see this if I give examples. And I'll give you sort of two examples. One, India, like most other countries, half of India's population is female. In the 1990s, there were more women in the Indian workforce than there are today. India has had women prime ministers and presidents.
Which is something the United States still does not have, yes.
Does not have.
Yes.
And they are India, and they are women in academia, in legislature, in the corporate arena. But why is it that when the global average is around 39-40% for female workforce participation, India has declined from 36 to around 22% in the last 3 decades? The problem lies in a very old patriarchal feudal society which has not yet reconciled how it views women and their role in that society.
Mm.
And that has to be resolved. I mean, the Indian national struggle, Indian freedom struggle, spoke about the role women played. Women actually fought. I mean, women died in the freedom struggle. And the Indian constitution guarantees women equal rights. And yet, we are still quite far away from that goal. Second, is the issue of caste, caste-based discrimination. Again, like gender-based discrimination, the Indian constitution in 1949 guaranteed and eliminated any caste-based discrimination. It was quite a socially progressive constitution. Yet, even today, 72 years later, members of the lower caste, untouchables, you'll find incidents, you just Google, you'll find incidents of people being attacked, people being lynched, people being killed. So why is it that 7 decades later, you still have people who don't believe women should play a role, don't believe women should be out in the workforce, and don't believe that a lower caste person has a right to drink water from the same tap that you do? There is a struggle, and that's what I call that, you know, these two ideas of India need to be reconciled for there to be social cohesion and for society to move forward. And now the question will be, how does it matter to India's foreign policy? It matters because India's desire to be a global power, India's desire for that global power status requires that the world community and people around the world are comfortable with how India sees itself. And so if there is lack of social cohesion, which India actually had for the last few decades, till quite recently, India was viewed as a democratic, plural, secular, tolerant society. If there is a change in that perception of India, if India is viewed as no longer being democratic or no longer being as plural and open and secular as it used to be, if it's viewed as a country which is more interested in, you know, putting women in their place or minorities or sort of deciding what role the caste system can play, then that is going to clash with that sort of the image that the world has of India. And it's going to be difficult for the rest of the world to provide India the status that Indians demand in the world.
And so that sort of speaks to that issue of soft power and perception, yeah, that India has always leveraged very strongly, very effectively to this point. And so, yeah, that will be very interesting to see how that continues forward. And kind of moving on to just go by chapter here. And of course, this is very high level. Encourage everyone listening to please purchase the book, because it's impossible without taking several hours to unpack the wonderful information inside. But just moving on to this second chapter, from more of the gender and caste based discussion to one of infrastructure and one of national development. You do make the comparisons across several pages between India and China. Of course, uh-huh, the comparisons are somewhat natural. Like you said, the two countries with that exclusive club of over a billion citizens within their borders. But two very, very different approaches to government and society and economics. Democratic, one closed, one communist, one not. And it's interesting to see, you mentioned China has fostered a set of practices to develop its cities rationally, from funding to governance and so forth. And this is a discussion that's even echoed, I would say, perhaps to a somewhat lesser degree right now because it's an election year, but over the past several years with America comparing itself to China, why can China build literally cities inside of a decade, gleaming skyscraper-led cities, and we still have crumbling bridges and roads here in America? Yeah, you have a similar discussion for India, that the Indian government needs an estimated $1 trillion plus to catch up with urban planning and affordable housing. Can you unpack that infrastructure challenge and how India might approach that?
Sure. I agree with you. I mean, you know, sort of if one travels to China or even parts of East Asia, the infrastructure there is much better than in many parts of, I would say, Europe or the United States. But sort of, you know, at one stage, most of the infrastructure built in this country was built, right? So all the I-95s, I-20s, all of these built during the Eisenhower administration were built so as to provide both ease of transport and, you know, and movement. And they've helped with the integration of the country. They also help with building the economy, right? And moving people around. India's problem has been that India has a history of, you know, building infrastructure decades ago, centuries ago, actually. But in recent years, there has been a start and stop. So the Indian government first spoke about building infrastructure in the, let's say, 1999-2000. We are 20 years later, and India is still talking about the need to build infrastructure. So most of the problem is threefold. One, the government knows what to do, The government knows how much funding it requires, and yet it is unable to consistently implement and within a few years even build the infrastructure. They'll go with one project and then all the others get left behind. Second part of this infrastructure is also, you know, India is increasingly urbanized. India actually used to be more urbanized. It has sort of, you know, during the British times and later it became less urbanized. Anyway, as India becomes more urbanized, cities need more investment. But the Indian governments have traditionally invested more in the rural areas, both because of that is where the voting public is, and two, because of the belief that, you know, cities don't really matter as much as rural areas do, ideological reasons. And third part of it is, if you don't build infrastructure here, I mean both physical as well as human. You need the roads, but you also need electricity, you need water, you need sanitation, you also need, to sort of the human capital part, which is education, healthcare, and then you need, you know, training of your workers, you need investment in R&D, all these areas. There has been investment in certain parts for certain periods of time, but there has been no consistent investment over the years. Just to throw out two figures. If you want to grow an economy seeking high growth, normally invests in research and development, R&D. The US invests around 2.7%. The global average is around 2.3%. India's is less than 0.6%. Second figure, 7 decades after independence, Sri Lanka's literacy rate is higher than India's literacy rate. And sort of it's interesting. Because, you know, in the day and age we live in, you need an educated workforce. You also need a skilled workforce. Final stats I'll throw. Industrialized countries, skilled workforce is 60%, 60. India's skilled workforce is 7%.
Those are significant numbers, and those are very impactful numbers when you view the future of the economy and of the sustainability of the national development and the ability to raise people out of poverty and keep the economy moving on a competitive growth track. And yet it is impressive, moving on even to the next chapter, speaking about economics, that even with all these challenges, you say by 2050, just 30 years from now, India is slated to be one of the three largest economies in the world. That it has succeeded in doubling the life expectancy inside of a 70-year period, a country that was once very, very significantly challenged by the issue and the threat of famine now has the food reserves that you speak of as well. And of course, I would say from an American perspective on the outside, most people readily identify India with high tech and with many PhD students here in the States who come to visit. What are some of those areas of strength, some of those silver linings that you see that maybe India can leverage to overcome some of the obstacles that you mentioned that they face?
So India's advantage, first and foremost, is its working age population, right? So India will be one of those areas where of India's population's average is going to be between 25 to 27 years in age, which means unlike China, which is starting to gray already, India's population will not gray for a few decades right now. So for about 3-4 decades, India will still have a majority of its population in the working age group, which means that if the population is skilled and educated, India has a demographic dividend. Second, India has managed to grow at around 8 to 10% for about a decade. India's growth has slowed down, but if India is able to sustain between, let's say, anything upwards of 6% growth rate every year for the next 2 or 3 decades, then India will be able to achieve a lot, pull even more people out of poverty. And it can be the hub where, let's say, companies, both American, Japanese, Taiwanese that are moving out of China are looking for other countries to go to. They don't want to go too far away. And India is right across the border from China. So they are moving out of China and they want a country which has a large population, a country which can provide them economies of scale, which has cheap labor, but which is skilled. India could be the country that they can move to. Now, things India will have to do, but if India does leverage itself properly, it could attract those companies moving out of there, and that would actually, you know, serve the geostrategic purpose of decoupling from China.
Well,
and
I noticed even in the last few years, on a very daily, mundane example that I follow news from Apple, that iPhones are now being made at a significant growing level inside of India as they look to diversify, like you're saying.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So like Apple, you know, IBM, there's so many companies. Google has announced that it's going to invest about $10 billion over the next 10 years in India to build the digital and IT infrastructure. So, you know, the sort of India has an advantage in the digital. What it needs to do is build up its manufacturing, because Garrison, you and I know, I mean, you know, smaller countries can build their economies on solely on service. A country with 1.3 billion people needs most of the people in manufacturing.
Yes,
absolutely. Not in agriculture. And they cannot all be in the service or IT sector.
Yes, you need that. You need that manufacturing strength because it does tend to continue to provide sustainable growth, even during time periods where the domestic economy may be facing struggles or growing pains. As long as you have good free trade relations, you can still be the manufacturer of the world, which has been the success story of China, I think, for the last 20 to 30 years. But I can tell you from an American perspective, many of us have long held this view, and much of the country is now coming to it as well. We'd much rather have things, if they can't be made here, make it in India, make it in a democracy, not in communist China.
Yeah. And so, I mean, India can leverage that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and that brings me to some of our final questions, because I do want to be respectful of your time. But the portion of the book that's probably the most exciting for me, given my personal studies, being the geopolitical side. And it really is, and we kind of touched on this even just a second ago with manufacturing, but also in more hard power and diplomatic relations with the neighbors. India lives in a very interesting neighborhood. You know, you have China on the one side, you have Pakistan on the other, interesting relations with Russia that date back through the non-aligned time period in the Cold War, and even in not too distant regions, rising Southeast Asian countries, as well as Iran in the other direction. And yet, India can speak with a straight face about the times that it interacted with Rome, with Greece, with Egypt, with Mesopotamia. Not many countries can say that. That's a phenomenal length of history and time. How does its history inform the present that it now faces, geopolitically speaking?
As I say in the book, Indians actually sort of, you know, deeply believe that everything that is done in almost every area of life, whether it's foreign policy, economy, or even their personal life, their past in many ways defines their present and their future. So as you said, you know, India, when the Indian prime minister or president meets the Egyptian prime minister or president, they can talk about the relations going back centuries. They can also talk about more modern relations during the non-aligned struggle and sort of absolutely new relations dealing with how India is helping Egypt with democracy and elections. So India has the advantage of history, and sort of one of the other advantages of history that India has, which, for example, China does not, and you know, many countries like England or the colonial powers in Europe don't have, is that Indian empires, with one exception, never actually left the Indian subcontinent and never sought to conquer other parts of the world. So India isn't viewed as a hegemonic, imperialist, expansionist power.
You haven't inherited a whole bunch of enemies made over the last 500 years.
Have not.
Unlike Britain, yes.
So, you know, there isn't that baggage of history in that sense. But the baggage of history does play out is in India's immediate neighborhood, with neighbors, whether it's China, whether it's Pakistan or any of the South Asian neighbors. There is baggage, but that's a little more recent history. It's not old history. So it helps India in that India sort of has, sort of doesn't have to worry about a country saying that, you know, 40 years ago, you robbed us of this, or 70 years ago, 100 years ago, you took this away from us. So you don't have to worry about that legacy. So that helps. Second, there's a lot more soft power. So there's yoga to Buddhism to, for example, you know, Indian doctors, nurses, and teachers have been present and are still present in many parts, in many African countries, in the Pacific Islands, in many other parts of the world. And obviously, I'm leaving out things like Bollywood or cricket or Indian food. But India has a sort of a soft power which helps it. And finally, the problem which comes with this is that while India has civilizational, let's say, advantages, while India has soft power leverage, at the end of the day, and you're a student of international relations, countries respect power.
Yes.
And when we talk about power, we have not yet added soft power to what we mean by power. When we talk about comprehensive national power, we're talking about military, we're talking about economy, and maybe these are, we're talking about technology, but it's primarily military and economy. How big is your army? How strong is your army? Your navy and your air force, what equipment do you have? How many resources do you spend on it? And how fast is your economy growing? India's challenge comes on that hard power front. While India's economy has grown periodically, it is not one of those three countries in the world which to date have grown at 8 to 10% for three decades, which are China, South Korea, and Taiwan. That's all. India has not yet reached that. Secondly, India has a large military, but India does not have a great power military as yet, because we don't put enough resources and funding into it. India's, for the last few years, India's sort of military expenditures as a percentage of GDP is only 1.5%, the majority of which goes into salaries and pensions. Mm. That is not the percentage that you need to spend. Forget about being a great power or a global power. Just to be a regional power based on the neighborhood you are living in.
Yes, well, especially the neighborhood that it finds itself in.
Yes. So it's China, yes, you have all the other South, you have Pakistan, you have Middle East to one side, you have Southeast Asia to the other.
Well, and you also mentioned that India, unlike certain countries, perhaps say like, you know, just for an example, like a Pakistan or an Iran or some other rising powers of Brazil, perhaps, where they're in their region have strong land-based armies, and that makes up for the lack of a navy. India is also completely surrounded by water, and yes, is very dependent on global trade. And yeah, so it does seem to have a twin simultaneous challenge of becoming more significant in its hard power, not only on the land, but also on the water. I was hoping to close out the discussion with a couple of questions pertaining to maybe contemporary events, if you're willing,
which
would be, first of all, the ongoing border crisis between India and China, which I know from other interviews with members of the Indian foreign policy sector have discussed as something that's actually been going on for half a century. But to many Americans, this is new. Why is China and India fighting over a border in the Himalayas? And so perhaps you can kind of break that down in light of your book, in light of these discussions, with the significance of what's going on there.
Sure. So the India-China border standoff is old. You know, it's one of the, let's say, the legacies or inheritances that India obtained from the British, from the 200 years of British rule. When the British left the border, which India, so India is one of those sort of, you know, all post-colonial countries have had borders which were imposed on them. India's borders, border with China was drawn by the British when they left. India accepted the borders it inherited. China has never accepted any border it inherited, whether it is on the land or in the sea. And so China has over the years tried to, you know, for example, they're building islands and they've built islands in South China Sea.
The infamous nine dash line. Yes.
So sort of, you know, they sort of, you know, whether it's Mongolia, it's Russia, it's Japan, it's Southeast Asian countries, it's Myanmar, it's India. China has never accepted its border. The border issue is old. Tied to it is the India-China rivalry, the sort of Chinese belief that Asia is a Chinese area of regional preeminence, and India's unwillingness to accept Chinese primacy, not just in South Asia, but also in the Indian Ocean in Asia. But the current border standoff, which has actually gone on for about almost 5 months now, is the latest in a series of such standoffs. In the last 8 years, this is the fourth standoff. In the last 3 years, this is the second time the two countries have had a standoff. This is the longest in current history. And it has to do with the fact that, so Beijing's, let's for lack of a better word, let's say their playbook is, that what China does is, China will try to change the status quo on the ground. So whether it is, creating an island or, sort of extending its sort of economic zone in the sea. On the border with India, what China has consistently done is every now and then Chinese troops will try and take over territory which does not belong to them. And when the other side protests, then there's saber rattling, there are some shots fired, or the two sides there are some clashes that has happened. And then China insists that, let us have negotiations. Negotiations go nowhere, but they are dragged on for so long that in the end of the day, the other country, which is a democracy, will say, okay, let's accept it and let's move on. So in effect, China has started the crisis, blamed the other side for it, threatened escalation of war, and ended up gaining territory. So it's a two-step forward, sometimes no step back. And that's what China tried to do in the last few months. It has taken over additional territory in what is the Union Territory of Ladakh, or former state of Kashmir, Jammu, Kashmir, Ladakh in India. It's trying to take over its additional territory and trying to prevent India from building any infrastructure out there. Why does it matter? Because China has, over the last two decades, built a lot of infrastructure on its side of the line of control, line of actual control, as India and China call it. That infrastructure enables China to bring in tens of thousands of troops across Tibet right to the Indian border. So India has been slower in building this infrastructure. Why should the world care about it? Three reasons. Both are nuclear-armed countries. Nobody wants a war. Two, this is just another, whether it is threatening or blowing up a Vietnamese fishing trawler, sending or threatening, attack against Taiwan or against Japan. The same thing that China is doing along the Himalayan border, is threatening a democracy and hoping that the democracy will by default not fight back for fear of war. But it is another way of Chinese aggression. And third, it matters because if the world, and especially if the United States and its allies, believe that India should be a partner in the Indo-Pacific, then they should, one, care about what is happening on the India-China border. Two, India needs support. But India doesn't necessarily need troops on the Himalayan border. American or foreign troops. But it does need diplomatic support. It does need economic and military support.
And how do you feel that has been thus far? Do you feel like it is being supported?
It's actually been good. It has been. Japan, China, India, Australia are part of a grouping called the Quad. And the Quad has met a number of times. India has military logistical agreements with all of these countries. The U.S. has provided, obviously, covertly, intelligence cooperation. There are also supply parts and military equipment that the U.S. is selling India, which is helping India along the border. And the U.S. has openly said that China is the aggressor, not India.
Yes, I do recall that, and I was strongly happy to hear that that was the case. As we continue to see how that plays out along the border, and as we continue to watch the developments inside of India, to head to the conclusion of your book, and one of the final questions for today, You mentioned a very interesting story that took place in July of 2019, where the finance minister at the time, who was used to bringing in budget documents inside of a so-called red box, something that had been left over from British tradition, decided to carry it in a traditional Indian accounting ledger. And I'm not going to attempt pronunciation out of respect for the Indian language. They don't need me butchering it. But he made the announcement rather proudly, possibly even defiantly from what I read here, that the British have left, their traditions should also come to an end. And you mentioned that India is very good at setting forward such symbolic moments of transition from colonial to post-colonial, of adjusting this policy or that tradition or so on, but that it has yet to truly capture the importance of, if you're going to be a superpower, then you're going to have to change more than just the symbolism. And could you kind of maybe close us out on a discussion of maybe some of your top things that you feel like India could readily do to start heading on the way to being the great power that it's already becoming beyond symbolism?
Sure. Sort of, you know, just a few things. One, on the social front, India's advantage has been its soft power image to the world as a democracy, as a plural, open, tolerant society. Around 14 to 15% of India's population is Muslim. 3 to 4% is other religions. And if sort of, you know, no democracy is perfect, but India has done a moderately good job. The last few years have not been too good. And so it would be good if India could go back and the government could respect what is written in the Indian Constitution and what is enshrined in the Indian Constitution. Because when you are dealing with a neighbor on your border who is a rival, and who has taken territory like China, the best sort of counter in the world is to offer the India image. And the India model is one which is totally counter to the China model. That a democracy, which is diverse, can still grow economically and militarily. So first, I would say, is, you know, retain sort of, you know, the democratic and pluralist credentials of the last 7 decades. Two, India's last economic reforms were in 1990-1991. It's 3 decades. India needs the second generation of reforms. And the policymakers know what to do, which would be primarily land, labor, and capital market reforms. And these can be done. They're not difficult to do. And considering the fact that right now India needs a massive economic boost, this might be the time to implement reforms, as people would be willing to undertake some hardship for the sake of higher economic growth. Third, India's sort of, you know, any country seeking to become a regional player, let alone a global power, indulges in long-term planning. India's military and strategic arena have always lacked planning. Now, planning takes 2-3 decades, but you have to start someday or the other. And therefore, if India starts sort of planning now, we will be able to see the impact of that in 5 to 10 years. But if we don't start it now, we'll never start the process of defense planning, which is, okay, so 20 years out, this is how the world will look. So I need to plan for what I need to do. 5 years out, this is how the world looks. So even 40 years out, how the world looks. So these, I would say, are the sort of, and fourth and final, every country's strength is its people. India needs to invest more in its people. India needs to invest in education. India needs to invest in skill development, healthcare, and infrastructure, including cities. But it needs to invest in its people, because that is what is going to help it achieve its goals of being a global power.
Well, and on that note, unfortunately, I'm going to have to wrap it up, because I could keep you here for several hours discussing the entire book. But Dr. Pandey, just want to say thank you so much for your time, for your expertise, and for giving us this wonderful book. And for the listeners, if you look in the show notes when this is published, there will be a link to Making India Great, The Promise of a Reluctant Global Power, now available on Amazon, I believe on ebook as well as print. Yes. And I highly encourage you to pick it up. Fascinating book. And a wonderful authoress who has given us her time today. And we say thank you very much for coming on the New Diplomatist podcast.
Thank you so much, Garrison. It was a pleasure.